Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Joe Biden's first big legislative push is that $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. Anticipating the slog, on Sunday, at least a dozen Senate Republicans and Democrats met in a virtual call with top White House aides, including Brian Deese, director of the White House National Economic Council. Well, here's Deese speaking to reporters on Friday.
What I can tell you is if we don't act now, we will be in a much worse place, and we will find ourselves needing to do much more to dig out of a much deeper hole.
And here's a preview of the pushback Biden is getting. Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania brought up this argument in Janet Yellen's confirmation hearings for Treasury Secretary.
We're looking at another spending blowout. The only organizing principle that I can discern is it seems to spend as much money as possible, seemingly for the sake of spending it.
Well, today we're going to dig into that relief package. What specifically does it propose to do? What difference would it make in the short run? What's the impact to the deficit? And are things like direct payments to Americans the best way to bring about a long-term recovery? Or are there better ideas that didn't make it into the bill? But first, let's listen to one American who's seeking some kind of relief, any kind of relief, from months of pandemic-driven economic hardship. Latrish Osecco. She lives in Delaware with her boyfriend and their 4-year-old daughter. And we first talked to Latrish last October. She'd lost her job, and they'd lost their home at the time, so the family had to move into a motel. So we reached out to her recently to see how Latrish is doing now, and she has some good news. They're out of the motel and in an apartment.
Yeah, I keep going back in my mind, and I picture myself how I used to cry and just look at the TV, look at the news every day. And I was sitting on a bed in a motel doing that, and I see these fools, Congress, fighting about back and forth and how I wanted to, you know, just have a place to be, like a home. And so now, you know, I still look at them fight, but at least we're in an apartment now.
So Latrish is grateful for the apartment, but there are still some problems. She says it's infested with roaches and they've had problems with the hot water. But through it all, federal economic relief has made a difference.
Continuing aid for sure would definitely be helpful and mean everything, you know, to our family, just because there are no jobs right now in sight. I mean, I continue to look and continue to search, and, you know, I haven't found a job yet that's, you know, willing to bring me on. I've done a few interviews here and there, but just knowing that, you know, I will have some kind of income to help my family survive all this is very helpful.
Latrish also told us that she feels more hopeful with the Biden administration in place.
I was very happy that it was finally said and done. I felt like I'm going to be included again because I felt so excluded with our previous administration. I think there's a brighter day for all of us, for many of us. I'm speaking about it when I say us, I mean the unemployed. It feels like, you know, we're going to get help. When I heard him say, I was looking at TV and I heard him talk and he said, help is on the way. I felt like, please, please help us.
But as you heard a moment ago, what Latrish really wants is a job. Even though it's temporary, she hopes for now, she does not like being on unemployment.
I would give anything right now to just go back to work, to have my daughter be in childcare, to be with her friends and to have a social life again. I would trade the extra money that Congress is giving, you know, on top of the unemployment. I would give all that back just to be able to go to work and daycare safely. I don't feel good when I'm not going to work. I don't feel a healthy part of society when I'm not going to work. And so I would trade at any moment to be able to do these things.
That's Latrish Osecco of Newark, Delaware. We talked to her first last October and checked in with her just over the weekend to see how she's doing. One of millions of Americans who have been suffering and struggling profoundly due to the damaged economy in the midst of this pandemic. So how would people like Latrish be affected by President Biden's proposed $1.9 trillion economic relief plan? Well, let's turn now to Erica Werner. She is a reporter for The Washington Post who covers Congress with a focus on economic policy. Erica, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if you might be able to just, first of all, describe what are the major hallmarks of the Biden proposal here? What are the most important parts of the bill?
The $1.9 trillion package includes several major proposals, including a new round of stimulus checks that would benefit people like your previous interviewee, Latrish. There's an extension of unemployment insurance, and it goes from $300 a week to $400 a week in emergency benefits. Those benefits are currently scheduled to expire in mid-March without action by Congress. There are hundreds of billions of dollars to help schools reopen, for a national vaccination program, for a big ramp up in testing and tracing, a child tax credit, and an increase in the federal minimum wage. So a lot there.
So a comprehensive proposal here. Is the numbers really matter, Erica? So help me understand something. Is the biggest part of that $1.9 trillion that the direct aid that the president's proposing?
Yeah, that's something like close to $500 billion for that component of it. So yes, that is a big chunk of it. And that is already running into some pushback from members of both parties, because the way the checks are potentially structured, they could go to people with who make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year and have not actually suffered income loss during the pandemic. So there's a bipartisan desire to see the checks be more targeted. This could potentially create a political problem for President Biden, because, as you know, he campaigned in Georgia for those Senate races, promising voters that if Democrats won, they would all be getting $2,000 checks. Democrats did win, and now President Biden really has to deliver on that.
Right. So I'm shaking my head here a little bit, because the numbers matter, because from what I understand, the $2,000 total, though, comes from the $600 per American that was passed in the winter by Congress before the end of the Trump administration, plus the additional $1,400 per person that Biden's proposing here. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And you raise a point that has become actually a problem, which is that saying $2,000 checks in the minds of some people, including apparently the administration, has kind of become shorthand for actually $1,400 checks, which on top of that $600 already passed equals $2,000.
Yeah.
But there are some liberal Democrats in Congress, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who are saying that the number needs to be $2,000, a new $2,000, not $1,400.
Right.
So you have pressure from the left saying it needs to be bigger, pressure from kind of the center and the right saying it needs to be smaller. And the administration's going to have to navigate through that.
It's quite a thicket to navigate through because, as you just pointed out, on this meeting that happened yesterday with sort of more centrist Republicans and Democratic senators, to your point that you were making, they even want to just have those payments be more targeted so that not every American might get those additional checks. But Erica, I wonder if the focus on these checks, maybe because they're just the easiest thing to understand, if that is potentially forming a major political pitfall for the Biden administration in that it's taking away attention from other aspects of the bill that could actually be more efficacious when it comes to long-term recovery. I mean, there's the proposal to raise the federal minimum wage. There's the extra money for schools. There's the assistance for state and local governments that desperately need some kind of funding to sort of keep their services going. Are all these things at risk of being overshadowed by the debate over checks?
I think that's you raise a good point, which is that the checks themselves have kind of taken on this symbolic quality where there is a lot of focus on it. As you say, it's easy to understand, but many economists don't think that that is the best way to actually provide relief because you're kind of spraying money at everyone instead of targeting relief where it's most needed to those state and local governments, the schools, and elsewhere. And importantly, one very bipartisan area of agreement is money to ramp up vaccination. Mm-hmm. That was discussed a lot on the call yesterday, an area where Republicans and Democrats agree. If you get those vaccines out, that's how you reopen the economy. And in the minds of some Republicans, that's really all you need to do. And that's all they want to do is put money in vaccines, get the and they think the economy reopens on its own. That's something Mitt Romney, for example, has said. So there's really a lot of push and pull over multiple aspects of this proposal. And especially with the impeachment trial starting February 9th, it's going to be a difficult path forward for this package.
Well, Erica Werner is the Washington Post congressional reporter who focuses on economic policy, giving us a first taste into what's in that $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan proposed by President Joe Biden. Erica, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So when we come back, we'll dig more deeply into the bill and ask this question: are the best ideas for long-term recovery baked into this proposal? And if not, what might those ideas be? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're digging into President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID economic relief proposal, trying to understand what short-term impact it might have and whether or not it contains the best ideas for long-term economic recovery in this country. We heard a lot from On Point listeners who wanted to have their say about the need for COVID economic relief. Here's Steve from Richmond, Virginia.
We need aid immediately and now. trying to do a giant bill to get all the progressive ideas through, while would be a good thing for the country. Unfortunately, I think it would just get holed up, and then the people who are suffering now will have to wait even longer.
That's Steve from Richmond, Virginia. And a little later in the show, we're going to be hearing from Congressman Hakeem Jeffries about exactly the issue Steve is bringing up, whether or not Biden and his congressional allies can get this bill through Congress. But joining me now is Lily Roberts, Managing Director of Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress, and she's with us from Washington. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also with us is Kevin Mumford. He's a professor of economics at Purdue University, joining us from West Lafayette, Indiana. Professor Mumford, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Lily Roberts, let me start with you. What do you think are the most important parts of this COVID relief package? Because I just would just like to focus on that for a minute with the presumption of let's allow ourselves to imagine if those parts passed, what impact would they have on the country?
I think the most important part here to consider is the fact that we're talking about both public health and economic funding. So pairing economic stimulus and relief, you know, the unemployment insurance, the relief to states and localities with a significant tranche of public health spending, funding that would go towards vaccine distribution, that would go towards public health employment, trying to bolster some of that so that we can address some of the underlying health disparities. But basically taking both of those things in tandem as the way to get to a robust economic recovery.
Mm. And if those parts go down with a bill or get hived off, so much focus is on those direct to American stimulus checks. What's your concern there?
Well, I think one of the most immediate crises would be, not having unemployment insurance extensions. We have a huge, tens of millions of people are still receiving unemployment insurance. In the month of December, we actually had new claims go up for the first time since the spring. We're at, really high levels of unemployment overall, but in particular occupations, that's extra high, as well as, Black workers are at almost 10% unemployment. So one of the biggest concerns is that in order to stave off a really long-standing recession or even a depression, we need to keep those tens of millions of people with a steady stream of support. So keeping that unemployment insurance extension is really the thing that I think is the biggest bang for the buck there.
Okay. So Kevin Mumford, I'm going to come to you in a second, but Lily Roberts, another quick question here, because, I think one of the things that we in the media need to do a better job of is these are enormous, complicated bills with lots of different ideas, and we tend to sort of just throw a stone across the surface of them and talking about them. So I want to be sure to get as much detail as I can from both of you. There's an idea about putting things like guaranteeing some sort of paid leave for American workers in the bill, too. Do I have that right?
That's right. So in the spring, Congress passed an emergency paid leave program. It's a pretty common sense public health tool, I think. In a pandemic, you want people to be able to take time off from their job if they think they've been exposed to COVID. If someone in their family needs care for COVID, we don't also want them to be going to work. That provision expired at the end of December, and it did not make it into the last minute haggling that took place in Congress at the end of 2020. So resuming that paid leave program would go really far to keeping people attached to their jobs, but also to sort of helping with the, keeping the spread of COVID in check.
And is the Biden proposal specific to COVID, or is he trying to get sort of permanent paid leave? Paid leave is a permanent idea in here.
For now, the Biden proposal is just a proposal, and I think that legislators will take that and expand on it in some places and use it sort of more verbatim in others. Paid leave is a place where, this is a really showing the clear need that's always been underlying the economy for paid leave. So I think that there would be some discussion about using an emergency, starting with an emergency plan and moving that towards a longer term solution for American workers.
Okay. So Kevin Mumford, given the whole raft of ideas here in this very large bill, do you think that President Biden has offered a proposal that would take the country down the path to long-term recovery.
I think that right now is a really good time to be doing some sort of stimulus. I mean, yes, the U.S. has had a long-term fiscal problem with high current and projected deficits, but interest rates are very low, which means that the cost of stimulus is very low because the cost of borrowing is low, and the benefits are very high. Throughout the duration of the entire pandemic, the benefits are high. So I think Lily and I are broadly in agreement that now is a very good time to be doing stimulus. And I think that we also agree on what the priorities are. That is, it's health spending, things to stop the virus, and expanding unemployment insurance benefits. That extending those expanded unemployment insurance benefits, really great way to have targeted relief that helps those who most need it.
But I hear you heading towards a but.
Well, not everything in the proposal is as beneficial as some of those priorities. And unfortunately, some of the things that, you know, have the biggest price tags are the things that are probably least effective.
Including the
direct stimulus payments are not particularly effective. And the other thing is that to the extent that things like putting the minimum wage increase packaged into a bill altogether will just slow down the process, it feels like getting these really essential things passed quickly is more important than trying to get everything into one bill.
Okay, so let's focus then a little bit, though, on why you're saying that those direct payments to Americans may not actually be the most effective way to get the economy on more stable footing in the long run. So in order to do that, I want to actually just circle back to Latrish Osecco. We heard from her a little earlier in the show. She lives in Delaware and has been really suffering a lot because of the pandemic recession. She lost her job, has been on unemployment, very suffering from a lot of housing instability. But we asked her about those direct cash payments that had been part of previous bills. And what did she do with the checks when she got them?
What I did was I just decided to save them because there's so much going on. And after being homeless and everything and getting to that spot, you just never know what's going to happen. So I just banked them for necessities, food or anything we may need throughout this time.
So Kevin Mumford, she didn't spend it. How many other Americans did what Latrish did?
Well, it turns out we don't know much from the most recent stimulus, but from the 2020 CARES Act, at the beginning of the pandemic, those were the $1,200 payments to each qualifying adult, and then $500 for qualifying children. The evidence seems to be that the effect of these payments was broadly similar to those that the federal government enacted in 2008 and in 2001. But by comparison, they're larger payments and seem to have been a little bit less effective. That is, the recipients were even less likely to spend the money received than in 2008 and in 2001. Now, it's initial evidence. It's still early. But back in 2008 and 2001, it seemed as though they had a marginal propensity to consume of about one-third after three quarters. And this time, we're seeing numbers that are closer to just 20%. Mm. So that is that, yes, these payments are going to help make recipients better off. But when they're not spent, they don't have the added benefit of helping the economy.
Right.
And so it's not that... It's not that those individuals receiving it are somehow made worse off by receiving the money. Although, at some point, we're all going to have to pay higher taxes to be able to make up for it. And so for those that don't really need it, it's probably not good to be providing everyone in the whole country with these checks.
Lily Roberts, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. So I would first of all say that, there was a phase out for that first round of CARES Act checks. People with very high incomes didn't receive them. And so they are in a way targeted. But I think that, dollar for dollar, yes, I would rather spend, if I have only $2 and I have to spend them both, I'd rather spend them on unemployment insurance or other programs that go straight to, for example, food assistance or reopening schools. But I will also say that unemployment insurance is a leaky safety net. There are many people who are jobless who don't get unemployment insurance. In the spring, we had systems crashing online. We had people who thought they were eligible but weren't eligible. Believe it or not, there are people who work but don't make enough money to qualify for unemployment insurance. All of those people should have received checks. And I think that that's a really crucial aspect of this. There's also another element of the Biden plan that I want to highlight here related to the checks, which is that there are people who were excluded from the CARES Act. For example, people who were claimed as adults who are claimed as dependents on other adults' taxes. Most of those people are, you know, adult students or they're people with disabilities. Those people did not receive CARES Act checks, and trying to expand eligibility it would be a really important improvement for the program.
Now, Kevin Mumford, I'm still thinking of what Latrish Osecco told us about why she banked the check. And it's because she cannot anticipate a near future that is not full of instability. She still doesn't have a job. I mean, you heard her say earlier that more than anything, she doesn't even want the check. She wants a job. So it makes a lot of sense to me that that many Americans, because they cannot feel any sense of security in the next coming, you know, months, would want to have some kind of cash in the bank to hold on to. But about that bigger issue about the long-term stability, do you see any parts of this bill that would do things like help people like Latrish get back to work?
Well, absolutely. I mean, all of the points that Lily, you know, was highlighting about the need for expanded unemployment insurance benefit and other types of these targeted programs, food assistance and other things, they definitely help the long-term health of the economy. I mean, if you have people who are unable to spend today, that's going to have repercussions that are long-lasting. And so providing that kind of targeted help right now is really important. I guess I'd also just add that I totally agree that the unemployment insurance program doesn't reach everybody. And I mean, it is kind of leaky, and it depends on which state you're in. Some states do better than others, but it's not as if the unemployment insurance is enough to cover everyone. I think the problem with the direct stimulus payments is that they hit so many people that are not affected. I mean, an alternative way to structure this would be to have some sort of clawback provision that says, now that we're, you know, a year later, we look back and say, what did your 2020 income look like as compared to your 2019 income? And for those people who really were affected by the pandemic, whether or not they could qualify for unemployment insurance benefits, we let them keep the money. But for everybody else, it's just an interest-free loan from the federal government, and you give the money back since you didn't really need it.
Well, you mentioned about having to pay for it eventually through taxes, and I want to just go straight to one of the issues here that Republican members of Congress are bringing up. Looks like deficit hawkishness is back in vogue in Washington, because here's Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa during the confirmation hearings for Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary confirmation hearings. And here's what he said.
With the trillions of already in the pipeline and close to $1 trillion in relief enacted just a few short weeks ago, it is very important to focus efforts on pandemic relief. Now is not the time to enact a laundry list of liberal structural economic reforms.
So Long Point listener Daniel from Oklahoma was thinking about concerns like that expressed by Grassley when he left us this message.
I would say a deficit that is designed with an intent to help 97% of America immediately via cash payments, unemployment benefits, and everything else is so much more American and so much more an egalitarian and judicious use of deficit spending than the upper 3% in the economy getting a $2.1 trillion tax benefit, essentially.
So, Lily Roberts, your response to these concerns about a ballooning deficit.
I think your listener, Daniel, from Oklahoma, said it exactly right, that this is a sort of concern about the deficit that only kicks in when we're talking about spending money on working class and middle class people. This concern about the deficit did not keep anybody from passing tax cuts for the very wealthy and for corporations in 2017. You know, if we're so concerned about the federal government's revenue and spending, it's much more efficient to tax some of that wealth that's coming in to American billionaires who increased their wealth by 26% in the past year than it is to haggle over $1,400 checks. I mean, I think the crucial thing to remember here is that economists, and particularly economists in policymaking, but I would say economists writ large, agree that government financing is not like a household budget. Right now, you know, as Professor Mumford said, we can finance government investments at bargain basement rates. There is no reason to sort of trump up these concerns about deficits when we can stimulate the economy now rather than falling into the trap that we fell into in 2009 about austerity and these concerns about the debt.
Well, Kevin Mumford, we've just got about 30 seconds before we have to go to a break. And I mean, I think the reasons that some members of Congress are quite concerned now, you heard it in Grassley's statement there where he looks at the deficit as an outcome of what he called the laundry list of liberal structural economic reform. Maybe it's not the deficit he's worried so much about, but that core economic reform that's being proposed.
If these are structural reforms, if they're going to have long lasting effects, then he's right to be concerned about it. But I mean, that shouldn't be a reason to postpone the really needed stimulus right now. And Lily's absolutely right. Economists widely support doing some sort of stimulus right now.
Well, Kevin Mumford and Lily Roberts, stand by for just a moment. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back about President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we are going to be talking about extremism in the United States military, especially after several of the people being charged following the January 6th attack on the Capitol were either current or former members of the military. So we want to hear from the military community out there, both active duty and veterans. Have you seen extremism in your ranks during your service? And how do you think, or what do you think, the military and the Pentagon should do to address the issue of extremism? We want to hear your stories, your experiences, and your thoughts at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're digging into President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan, understanding what's in it, understanding what effect it might have in the short run, and whether it contains the best ideas for long-term recovery. I'm joined today by Lily Roberts. She's Managing Director of Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress. Kevin Mumford also joins us as well. He's Professor of Economics at Purdue University. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the proposal to raise the federal minimum wage to $15. That's in the Biden plan here. That idea has really generated a lot of interest from our listeners. So, for example, here's Beth from Burlington, Vermont.
If everyone is starting to make $15 an hour, which would be wonderful, then down the line, those people that were making $15 an hour are going to want to be making $17 or $18. And all the way, everybody's salary is going to go up. And then after everybody's salary or per hour rate goes up, then the prices are going to go up. I just don't see how that is going to solve the problem.
And here's Melvin from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Cost of living wage should be between $25 and $30 an hour. So $15 an hour is quite frankly offensive.
Well, last week during Janet Yellen's confirmation hearings, again, she's the nominee for Treasury Secretary, this issue of a $15 federal minimum wage came up because Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina said it worried him.
It would increase the cost of doing business significantly. It would certainly devastate the opportunity to develop new jobs in rural America and in rural South Carolina, as well as for those minorities and women coming into the workforce. It would actually have a disproportionate impact on those folks that you said in your testimony you want to target for relief and opportunity.
And here's how Janet Yellen responded to that.
Right now, we have millions of American workers who are putting their lives on the line to keep their communities functioning, and sometimes even working multiple jobs aren't earning enough to put food on the table and a roof over their heads. And they're suffering in countless ways, especially during this pandemic, and really struggling to get by, and raising the minimum wage would really help many of those workers.
Now, Lily Roberts, if I'm recalling correctly, the last time the federal minimum wage was raised was 2009, I think, to $7.25. Is that right?
That's right. We're now at the longest time since the 1930s, since raising the minimum wage. During that time, you know, not only have we not raised the minimum wage, but it's lost purchasing power. $7.25 is worth almost a fifth less than it was a decade ago.
But you hear Senator Scott there and also one of our On Point listeners saying boosting it to 15 is just going to raise the cost of doing business and become a drag on the economy.
You know, this is another place where sort of the past 30 years of economics research has really coalesced around the idea that this choice between jobs and wages is a false one, starting with sort of this a seminal work of economists Card and Krueger in 1994. Economists have found that the overall number of low-wage jobs remains largely unchanged after minimum wage increases. It's a much more complicated relationship than just increase wage, lay off people. What happens is often that people have more money to spend. So they go out and they spend that money, which drives up consumption in a local area and leads to more business creation. Mm.
Kevin Mumford, do you see a $15 federal minimum wage as one of the proposals in Biden's package that could lead to a stronger long-term recovery?
I think it should definitely be stripped out of the bill. I mean, it's going to be a divisive issue. It's just going to slow things down. And where we really need the benefits are in the direct spending on stopping the virus and expanding unemployment insurance benefits. Minimum wage is going to be a very divisive issue. I'd also like to say that I don't agree with Lily's characterization of that the economists have coalesced around the idea that the minimum wage has no employment effects. I mean, there is pretty strong evidence that the negative employment effects are small, close to zero in the short run. But there's also good evidence of long-term negative employment effects in the long run. That is that you see more of a shift towards automation and less job creation. it doesn't have, you know, no effect at all. Just like we would think when you put a minimum wage in place, it's not that it has no effect. It increases prices and it has long run employment effects. So it's not all positive.
To that long run effect, though, can we say that the minimum wage increase was causative? Because over the long run, I mean, you talked about automation, et cetera. There are other factors as well, technological advancements.
There absolutely are. I think, you know, the Cardin-Kruger paper that Lily mentioned, I think, is not believed anymore by any economists. Those estimates are kind of outlandish, and the identification was poor. I think that when it comes to the long-run effects, we look at papers more like Muir and West to show that it looks like there is a causal negative impact in the long run on employment. You know, I think the best evidence on the short-run effect probably comes from Toddy, from a 2017 paper. He's a Census Bureau employee who shows a small negative effect, just like you'd think. And that's because employers don't just immediately fire their workers just because the minimum wage went up by a dollar or two. Although we've never seen an increase ever of a doubling of the minimum wage. This would just be unprecedented. Going in where I live in Indiana, going from, you know, $7.25 up to $15 all at once, that would be incredible. Mm. I mean, that would just be something we've never seen before. And a one size fits all policy for the entire government, you know, for the entire country, just doesn't make any sense to me when there's so many geographic differences, so many regional differences.
Well, that begs the question of the existence of any kind of federal minimum. But I have to say, this is such an important issue that we will dive into it in the future about this proposal in particular in detail. And I'm fast running out of time with you because I've got Congressman Jeffries on the line here, and I want to turn to him in a second. But one last question, briefly, if I could hear from both of you on. Is there something that's not in this bill that you think would be a key part of setting up the country for longer term and stronger economic recovery? Kevin Mumford?
I really like the idea of direct payments with clawbacks. Okay. That is something automated where Congress doesn't have to vote on it, where when you have a recession, people get checks, but then if it turns out at the end of the year that you didn't have a downturn for you, you kept your job, you just give it back. And that's because the marginal propensity to consume goes down during recessions. Everybody wants some extra savings. It helps them feel safer. It really improves welfare in that sense. So the government could provide that. It just doesn't make sense to do it in this way where everybody keeps the money, whether or not they were affected by the recession.
Mm. And Lily Roberts?
Yeah, one of the things that I would love to see in any forthcoming legislation is a structural change, which would restructure the way we trigger off mm-hmm. unemployment insurance and other programs. One of the problems we've run into several times over the past year is that Congress says, okay, we're going to expand unemployment insurance. It's going to go through July or it's going to go through December. And then we have to spend 6 or 8 weeks scrambling and haggling over extending beyond that because, surprise, the pandemic wasn't over by that point. I think if instead we set a threshold, particularly related to the labor market, if, for example, you know, I mentioned earlier, the Black unemployment rate is nearly 10% right now. If we said unemployment insurance increases are going to stay turned on, not until an arbitrary month in the future, but until Black unemployment falls under 4%, for example, we'd be in a much better situation. We wouldn't have to keep haggling. And by we, I mean Congress. Congress wouldn't have to keep haggling and trying to get these extensions that often leave people with 3 or 4 weeks or even longer in between the benefits that they so right. desperately need.
So putting supports on autopilot and being more right. proactive rather than reactive, that is an idea worth a lot more mm-hmm. investigation, which I would love to do in a future show. But I'm going to have to let both of you go. Lily Roberts, Managing Director of Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Kevin Mumford, Professor of Economics at Purdue University, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries has been waiting on the line here. He's a Democratic congressman representing the 8th Congressional District of New York and chairman of the House Democratic Caucus. Congressman Jeffries, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on. Great to be with you.
All right. So first of all, give me your quick response to the pushback you've already been hearing that, you know, I get it. Progressives want Biden to go big or go home. but that there's so much in this bill that's already receiving, you know, questions of concerns from Republicans that it might end up going home.
I think we're going to get something done, and we're going to get something done sooner rather than later. I think Joe Biden has set the appropriate target to meet the moment. This is a once-in-a-century pandemic. It requires a once-in-a-century comprehensive, compassionate, and continuing congressional response. When you look at the level of pain and suffering and death, the fact that so many Americans are struggling with unemployment, with housing issues, with food insecurity. And so I think there's a commitment in the House to meet the moment. We know that the $900 billion package was only meant as a short-term bridge to take us to mid-March, which is why we're going to get to work to try to make sure that when we arrive at that moment in mid-March, we have a continuity of relief. We increase direct survival checks to the American people to $2,000 per person, that we provide an additional level of housing assistance, extend out the foreclosure and eviction moratoriums, as well as the supplemental unemployment insurance assistance.
Yeah. So unemployment insurance assistance, extending eviction and a foreclosure, moratoriums are critically important. But as you well know, there's already this big fight over that additional $1,400 check. You've heard in the course of this hour, and I'm sure on the Hill, ideas that maybe you can take the heat out of that battle by means testing that $1,400. I mean, and having more targeted payments. Is there any appetite in the Democratic caucus for that idea?
Well, I think there's an appetite to make sure that the relief goes to those Americans who need it the most. And means testing has always been part of the prior packages in terms of the direct payment survival checks. Everybody was eligible who was at or under $75,000 per year. I think the issue is that when you increase the amount to up to $2,000, the circuit breaker in terms of the declining amount related to eligibility is increased. In other words, right now, you still receive some portion of that direct payment check if you make up to $99,000. The issue is that if you increase it to $2,000, it increases that range, that ceiling. And so I think it's a reasonable discussion to have, and I think that Democrats on the Hill in both the House and the Senate aren't necessarily averse to making an appropriate adjustment as long as the targeted relief goes to working class folks, middle class folks, those who are aspiring to be part of the middle class, certainly the poor and the sick and the afflicted.
Mm. It's interesting to hear you say that because isn't the, you know, the progressive wing of the party right now really, really pushing the president to in fact abandon his bipartisan urges and to get this bill through Congress? I mean, honestly, how much willingness is there to compromise down on some of these, the portions of the bill?
Well, from our standpoint, in the House at least, we're prepared to move toward reconciliation if that becomes necessary. It's always preferable to the extent that you can reach a bipartisan consensus within a time frame that meets the moment to do it in that fashion, because it allows for the American people to receive the congressional action in a more robust fashion with bipartisan support. But in the absence of that, if the Republicans in the Senate are going to be obstructionists, if they're going to be intransigent, then we do have the reconciliation mechanism that will be available to us. And as you know, it was used in the past, most recently, for the GOP tax scam, mm-hmm. which is unbelievable, right? Because 83% of the benefits of a $2 trillion bill went to the wealthiest 1%. And if it can be used to enrich the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected, budget reconciliation can certainly be used to help out struggling Americans in the midst of a once-in-a-century pandemic.
We've just got about 30 seconds left, Congressman Jeffries. I wonder, I mean, the House is one thing, but are you concerned about possibly losing Democrats in the Senate?
I think that the Democrats in the Senate are going to rally behind doing what's necessary, particularly given the leadership of Joe Biden. He's got relationships with those senators. He's our commander in chief, and he's put this forward. I think people will do the right thing and come to a consensus on the Democratic side, and the 50 votes plus Kamala Harris will be there if needed, if the Republicans abandon any effort of doing the right thing.
Congressman Hakeem Jeffries is chairman of the House Democratic Caucus. Thank you so much for joining us, Congressman.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.